So let me begin by first thanking Piero Bassetti and the Bassetti Foundation for making this visit possible. We like to think in America that we are the world's most enlightened democracy, but when it comes to being enlightened about the Enlightenment, I'm not sure that we are adding much light to the world at the moment. So one has to travel to Italy to discuss some of these issues around science and technology and innovation that are dear to my heart and to the work of colleagues of mine in the field of science and technology studies. And I actually don't know what I would do without my European colleagues, sponsors, friends, and conversation partners these days. In that spirit, I would also like to thank Maria Chiara Talacchini, whom I cannot thank enough. For one thing, the book would not have appeared in Italian had it not been for her tireless work and that of Emanuela Gambini in making the translation possible. And so I'll simply give her a smile. And also, I'm very grateful for the people in this audience whom I already know. I'm glad to see close friends of mine here in the audience. And grateful to all of the rest of you for coming as well. I'd like this to be as interactive as possible because for me it's really a pleasure and a treat to be able to seed a discussion with some ideas but then get back responses to take away because I don't get that nearly often enough. So originally I wasn't going to prepare PowerPoint slides, because those of you who do this on a regular basis know about the tyranny of PowerPoint and the reductionism of bullets and of standard frameworks and all the things that I rage about in my scholarly life. But nevertheless, Maria Chiara assured me that in this case it would be better to have some visual English cues while I'm speaking so that people will have, you know, two senses with which to take in what I'm talking about. So I'll try to keep it short, even though what I'm going to be talking about is based on rather compressed years of empirical research, and I won't be able to elaborate all the points fully, especially you'll see there are several different tables, and the tables have cells that actually represent I don't know if two of these things are wrong, but the tables have cells that represent many years of, I think maybe it's the other one that's still on. Or, so I'll just present them to you visually and then maybe we can talk about them further. So I am, of course, an academic and an unabashed academic. That means that with other social science and philosophy and humanities colleagues of mine, and natural scientists who are actually better at this game than we humanists are, I invent language, and I play with language, and I participate in the production and development of new language. And one that I've been talking about lately is imaginary. I'm by no means the only person in the academic world who is discussing this, and I've added socio-technical in front of the word imaginary because I think the kind of thing I'm talking about is at once social and technical. And Lewis Carroll many years ago talked about portmanteau words in which you stuff things and carry them around. So socio-technical is like that. It's trying to compress things. English does it. Other continental European languages do it even better. German, of course, better than most. In any event, I'm switching from master narratives to imaginaries for a reason that I'll explain, because I think the two concepts are related. And it is something that we wrote about in this report that the Bassetti Foundation sponsored, translating into Italian, about taking European knowledge society seriously. Right, so my idea of imaginaries is based on comparative studies of science and technology policy and regulation over now nearly 30 years. And what one sees in that period of work is an evolution in the researcher's own consciousness of what's important to talk about and what has been going on. And this slide is a little summary of those facts. So the first generation of comparative studies of science and technology policy were undertaken largely in the 1980s. And contrary to what political scientists expected, those studies revealed that nations do differ in the regulation of science and technology. It was expected that they would not differ because Western nations have similar levels of economic development, similar levels of technological development, and above all, they're relying on the same basis of scientific and technical knowledge and facts. So there was expected to be no difference. And so when the differences were revealed, this was actually a finding that went against what was general expectation. But at the same time, those studies, for reasons we can discuss later, did not explore the knowledge assumptions that underlie political decision making. That was left to the second generation of comparative studies. I like to think that my book, Designs on Nature, is an example of this kind of work. In this second generation, people specifically decided that they would not accept either politics or knowledge as black boxes whose insights you cannot understand. Instead, there was a desire to open up and see what happens dynamically inside of these black boxes. Now, that kind of work tends to focus on micro issues, case studies of very specific kinds of things, at particular sites or locations of activity. So, for instance, not just regulation broadly, but regulation of specific things like stem cells might be one such site. At the same time, the world was undergoing changes and there were emerging problems, and I've tried to summarize those, you know, just in a signaling way. So this is also the 20-year period when, particularly in the United States, but elsewhere too, there's a lot of privatization. What previously used to be considered governmental responsibility is delegated down to other kinds of entities. At the same time, not surprisingly perhaps, there's a loss of trust in many leading institutions, and responsibility is being diffused throughout society in ways that all of us have trouble understanding in some sense. It also came to be recognized that the cross-cultural differences are not only at the level of state action, so differences in regulatory decisions and outcomes, but also at the level of public response. And that's what I refer to as reception. It's a term that's more often used in the humanities to talk about the ways in which audiences receive or take up signals. But that was an area that really had not been discussed or theorized in the first generation of comparative work, and it is relatively new that we as social analysts recognize that as a problem. Further, that innovation is a phenomenon that has an ethical and political dimension was not really recognized explicitly until quite recently. People took the master narrative of progress for granted. Of course the new is better, otherwise why would we have it? That was the kind of hidden assumption, and people are beginning to question that more widely. So imaginaries are an analytic concept that's trying to deal with this series of developments that I've laid out. To my mind, imaginaries are not simply master narratives, and so they're not simply discursive rationales. They represent forms of practice as well as forms of reasoning and life. One definition that I've used in my own work is the one that you see there, collectively imagined and communicated. The communication, I think, is important. Forms of social life that both embed and are embodied in, so that duality is important, two directions, in national, scientific, and or technological projects. To study imaginaries has both a descriptive rationale and a normative rationale. So descriptively, I think trying to get one's hands or one's mind around these imaginaries is a way of understanding why this puzzling discrepancy appears in areas of scientific and technological development where you would not normally expect to see variation, not across the Western world. I mean, there's something a little bit odd about American political leaders saying in 2002 and 2005, oh, Europeans are so superstitious, they're rejecting our GM agriculture, right? But this is an absolutely commonplace assertion that you hear in American agricultural biotechnology circles. Who would have predicted that something like 400 years after the Enlightenment, the United States would consider Europe to be superstitiously behindhand? At the same time, I think Europeans have lots of reasons to consider America rapidly becoming engulfed in eddies of superstition as well, though if this November election goes the way some of us hope, maybe there will be a little stopping point against that development as well. So descriptively, what is it that is going on? Why these discrepancies in places that you wouldn't expect to see them? But there are normative aims, and they're my aims. I'm very concerned that science and technology issues are not being debated in anything that I recognize to be democratic terms. But how do you do that? If you suggest that people should be more involved, the scientific and technological community immediately comes back and says, people are so ignorant, how can you possibly want them to be involved? Why you go and ask in the Eurobarometer, do tomatoes have genes or only genetically modified tomatoes? And people say by some large percentage, 50, 60%, only genetically modified tomatoes have genes. How can you go to such a population and get them to vote on, you know, anything to do with science and technology? In America, 90% of the people say that they have experienced miracles in their lives. 75% of people say they believe in angels, etc., etc. How can you possibly give them any power to decide scientific and technological issues? So I think that's a bad way of framing the question. It's not, you can't say we should withhold democracy from people because they don't understand. There's something fundamentally the matter with that position. So, you know, how do we begin to take, you know, how do we begin to address that sort of paradox? So I think that talking about these, what I'm calling imaginaries, and the master narratives that underpin them allows us to think of other kinds of possibilities for imagining the world. And that, I think, eventually can produce changes for the better in the ways in which we organize and run democracy. So, when I said imaginaries are more than master narratives, what I mean to say is that it's not just a question of words. We're talking here about long durée in historical terms. We're talking about ways of organizing conceptual thought in the political realm that are profoundly tied to political culture at many levels. One task of the analyst is to take very abstract concepts and try to operationalize them somehow. So what are the subordinate factors that make for some of these differences? And in what I will say next, I'll do some very quick and dirty comparisons between the United States and Germany, just to show that there are these patent, long-standing differences. I don't want to insist too much on particular language or particular findings. We can come back to that. But I think that if you look at governmental legitimacy in the United States and Germany, on the surface, when you look at them, of course, they're both constitutional democracies, and therefore, you would imagine that the principles and foundations are somewhat the same for both of them. Again, hardly surprising, post-war Germany was constituted to have a very similar constitutional structure to America anyway. So on top of everything else, there's sheer imitation. But if you look at what goes on below the level of the constitutional democracy, how it actually works in practice, you find very different ways of making those mechanisms come together, especially around these questions of how you link expert knowledge and capability to political work, to normative work. So I've tried to capture in this table something about those differences. So what about policy styles? How does government actually go about making decisions? Now, everybody in this room knows that America is the pluralist democracy par excellence. we organize in different interest groups and they fight things out and there's a lobby for everything. And, you know, any three people come together and create a t-shirt and there's a social movement. And you can, if you have money, buy airtime and buy web time and so on and so forth. In Germany, it tends to be still much more hierarchically organized. There's a sense that there are major established interests in the world and that these are organized in such ways that liberation happens at the peaks of these organizations. It is not the case that anybody can organize and grab a piece of the discussion. So, for instance, unless you manage to obtain more than 5% of the vote in a national election, you will not be represented. This idea of buying a single issue candidate in a state and getting them into the legislature, that's an American phenomenon, not a German phenomenon. Similarly, about the role of expertise, in America, I mean, this is a kind of important theoretical point that I make over and over. In America, the cultural understanding of objectivity is a kind of reason where no bias is apparent. So it's not anybody's standpoint. In a way, you can see how this is the other side of pluralism. If you have a society in which everybody gets into the act, then how do you get objectivity? It's to take every standpoint out and create a transcendental space. It's almost religious. You can also create it with mathematics. That's what we do a lot of the time. In Germany, I think the principles are much more Habermasian. You create the public sphere, make sure that all the people who belong in that public sphere are actually there. And so you have inclusion of the relevant viewpoints to produce a kind of rationality that is inclusive and total, not exclusion of viewpoints to produce this other objective space. So, as I say, in order to have discussion, I'm not going to talk about each of the boxes in this matrix. I just want to give you a sense of the overarching argument that political cultural differences between countries are institutionally grounded. They are features of a country's institutional structure. You can have constitutional democracy across the top for every European nation, and yet the ways in which you would fill in these boxes underneath would look different, and they produce differences in political style and scientific and technological policy and innovation as well. So to do comparative work, you can, of course, compare in a variety of different ways. And in my own work, I compare both cross-sectorally and cross-nationally. Cross-sectorally, in part, to get a historical sense of how things change and what doesn't change. Cross-nationally, to develop these comparative alternative ways of imagining the world. So in a research project that I'm currently doing, I'm comparing these socio-technical imaginaries in three countries, in the US, Germany, and with a colleague in South Korea as well. I won't talk about South Korea right now. So in this table, I compare American politics with respect to nuclear power, not nuclear weapons, but nuclear power, and the genome, or genetics and biotechnology more broadly. And what I want to say is that a message emerges from this comparison. It is that the United States is always pushing for innovation, but always with some sense that there are runaway features of the technology that need to be contained. So the technology itself is fine, but in the imaginary, the technology contains these things that could escape, and you have to contain them. And what could escape is conceived of as risks to people's health, safety, and environment. So it's very much a sort of physical, preventable set of risks that can be contained. It's particularly clear in the case of nuclear power, because, of course, nuclear power was actually born through a failure of containment. It was born in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and then the whole civilianizing of nuclear power has been, in America, a vast exercise in containment. The imaginary that was created by the bombings at the end of the war was uncontrollable, catastrophic damage. And then nuclear power, from the Atoms for Peace movement, Eisenhower's famous speech, through to today is about containing this threat in various ways. And there are some very interesting moments in this history. I'll just give you one of them because it kind of relates to Chernobyl in Europe, and you might be thinking about the European analog. We had Three Mile Island long before Chernobyl, 7 years before Chernobyl in 1979. And Three Mile Island wasn't a release of anything like comparable proportions. And of course, meltdown was averted. But people were very scared. Jane Fonda had starred in The China Syndrome just shortly before, and this seemed factually rather like the movie coming to real life. And I think people have forgotten which came first. China Syndrome came first, Three Mile Island came after. But then the plant was cleaned up, and it was supposed to be put back in operation. And one of the arguments that the American Citizens Group around that time made was, you should not start up that plant without undertaking a study of the psychological stress on the people living near the plant. Why should you do it? Because there's a law, the National Environmental Policy Act, which requires you to do an environmental assessment before undertaking a major federal political action. And they argued that this law, NEPA, required a psychological assessment. Now, the Supreme Court held that NEPA does not require this. But to my mind, it is one of these containment moments. If you allow people free rein to imagine the consequences of starting up Three Mile Island, who knows where their imaginations might run to? So what do? You shut down the imagination because you do not let psychological stress enter the picture. It's an illustration in very concrete terms of containing the imaginary by containing the democratic imagination by saying we have a law, Wir haben ein Gesetz, and you know that law does not allow us to consider the popular imagination. Playing on this a little bit in detail to give you a sense of the ways in which I, in my qualitative research, go quite far down into the technical details of what's happening in law and politics to support this sort of argument. So I think that in the genetics case, in a very parallel way, this containment and escape motif has been playing out again. Of course, with different details, but the idea of containment was explicitly borrowed from the nuclear area into the debates at Asilomar, which was, in a way, the starting point for governmental regulation of genetics. And two different kinds of containment were imagined, physical and biological. And so this, you know, risk escaping into the world and the governmental responsibility being about containment has stayed as a sort of continuous theme. And now it's in the nanotech area, and we're seeing some of the same kinds of debates happening again. So you turn to the German case, and if you look at the nuclear debate in Germany and the genomic debate in Germany, of course, uncontrollable problems around technological innovation are a continuity across the Western world. But what people are worrying about is rather different in the German case. And if you look at all of those different categories, the single word that Germans seem to care about that doesn't surface in the American debate is responsibility. So who is going to be responsible for the assessments? Who is going to be responsible for the catastrophes? Who's going to be responsible if there is an unholy alliance between science and the state, as has happened before in German history? So this question of where responsibility triggers in is very, very important. And then not surprisingly, given philosophical history as well, there are Kantian notions of certain foundational ideas that must be protected. In America, there is no public debate about a thing called human dignity that has to be protected at all costs. I think that it is bad history to say that Germans care about human dignity only because of the Holocaust. I think Germans care about human dignity because it is a concept that Germany has had for a very long time, embedded in the Kantian philosophical tradition, and when Germany needed to think how to protect itself against horrors like the Holocaust, it reached back into a historical and philosophical tradition that gives a certain position to human dignity. In America, the comparable word is not dignity, but life. and I'll talk about that more tomorrow, actually. The closures line is, of course, also interesting because in Germany, the ways in which the risks have been contained is through political innovations, whereas in America, the ways they have been contained is through expert reassurances, assessments, new techniques of risk assessment, and so on and so forth. So I want to finish up by saying a couple of things about how to think about politics against the backdrop of the kind of comparative discussion that I'm giving you. In general, I've argued in that book that Western societies are not doing very well at discussing the politics of innovation. And when I say ontological politics, I mean the politics of bringing new things into the world, new things with their associated new ways of living with those new things. So I think the question, what sorts of entities do we want in the world, has been sidestepped. I mean, mostly we seem to say, if somebody has the money to make it, then it comes into being. Only then do our imaginaries come into play and try to regulate them. So we haven't said as democratic polities, do we want the hydrogen bomb? Teller said yes and Oppenheimer said no, but that was not exactly a democratic debate. And the US government made sure that Oppenheimer's voice would not be heard on that score. So, you know, it was very different from what we might want in a democracy. Nobody said, do we want greenhouse gases? Nobody said, do we want the human genome? Nobody said, do we want human-animal chimeras, etc. I mean, these are things that come into the world without debate. So how are decisions to produce new things done? And, you know, to some degree, of course, they're done by experts who reassure us that it is okay. And in theory, by publics and their representatives, but it's not clear who the publics are or who their representatives are, and we can come back and talk about this. So at a meta level, it's not surprising that there are different visions of the good that are floating around under these innovations and these novelties, and we're also not very good at answering the question, supposing they don't agree. You know, what do we do if state policy, as in Britain, said agricultural biotechnology is just fine, and the British public said, no, sorry, we don't want, you know, there's not supposed to be in a democratic society huge gulfs of opinion between people and their elected representatives, but supposing there are, then what do we do? So are there forums, are there procedures, who participates in those procedures, and what about globalization? You know, because if even the British public and their leaders can differ on fundamental issues of innovation, what if it's Africa that's suddenly being told, we will innovate rice for you, stop eating cassava, stop eating yam, eat the rice because then you won't have infant blindness. I mean, you know, these are actual developments in the world, of course. So what I would resurrect here is a strong sense I have that in addition to assessment technologies, governing technologies of control and management, which I call technologies of hubris, we also need to think whether there is a parallel world of technologies of humility, ones that are more consequential, ones that claim less in terms of the controllability of innovation. And I think we can say something about what kinds of analytic positions, what kinds of analytic styles and traditions are absent in the world, and I've tried to summarize a few of these. So on the whole, when we think about innovation, we tend to think of the material consequences. Who will be harmed? How much financial damage will happen? And things like that. We do not tend to worry so much about what will happen to particular cultures, particular forms of life. A classic case is the Food and Drug Administration in the United States, when it was confronted with the issue of approving genetically modified bovine growth hormone, which would increase the yield of milk, an already heavily subsidized industry. And people said, that's not good for cattle. They're already being treated like little factories, and you don't want to make them yet more strained. And people said small farmers will be wiped out. Large farmers who can afford the economies of scale will be helped. The Food and Drug Administration said, sorry, those are not our concern. We are here to assure safety and security for people. That's our job. Go away. You must not bother us. But they didn't only say, go away, don't bother us. They also said, and by the way, you mustn't label your product saying that it uses recombinant bovine growth hormone, because you're sending a false signal to people that they have something to worry about. They have nothing to worry about. We, the FDA, have spoken. They have nothing to worry about. And so go away. So, you know, it's a whole sort of exclusion of a set of concerns which people had expressed. And the state of Vermont wanted to say you can have labeling in Vermont. Now, in American federalism, we often allow states to have their own way on various things. But why not on this? FDA threatened to take the state of Vermont to court so that Vermont manufacturers, who include Ben & Jerry's ice cream, a global brand now, you know, could not label their ice cream saying recombinant bovine growth hormone free ice cream. They're not allowed to do that. So that's a concrete example of the sort of thing I mean. Risk assessments tend to be rather short term, partly because of an economist mindset that says longer term things are not worth talking about because the discount rate brings them down to zero, and partly because we just don't know how to do it. We don't even know how to conceptualize and frame longer term risks. And yet, if we think about the environment, we're talking about sustainability, which is supposed to be forever. So how do we balance these kinds of things? I mean, maybe we just have to acknowledge that uncertainty is greater. And by reducing your eyes to the short term, you also increase the sense of certainty. And maybe we're better off sometimes revealing the sense of uncertainty that actually lurks right outside the borders. Normative issues, distributive questions are rarely considered in technical risk analysis. So consider the fact that we now have a market for carbon emissions. It's considered a great innovation of economic theory that you've taken intangibles that could not be priced, that were externalities before and you couldn't even think of them. And now you can think about them and you can actually figure out how to reduce pollution in one part of the world while, well, how to reduce it globally at the most efficient cost by allowing for trade-offs. And there's no doubt that it is a major economic innovation to figure out how to create a market in these things that have not previously been marketed. That's important. On the other hand, people pointed out from the mid-1980s onward that to price carbon CO2 molecules exactly the same throughout the world meant that you were not considering their history or the circumstances of their production. So a person with a rice paddy in India who's producing methane because of the agricultural production is selling and trading carbon dioxide on the same basis as the person in America who's consuming the third SUV in the family and is emitting gases in that way. So there's a very concrete example of a market being created with no memory and no place for inclusion and exclusion, for distribution and so on and so forth. So again, the problems I'm talking about are very concrete. That's what I want to make clear, that these are not sort of hypothetical arguments about what might happen or could happen and doesn't happen. It's what's going on right now. And then lastly, innovation is seen as so much of an unquestioned good that participatory rights, what participation even means, is not typically discussed. So the entire intellectual property system that we have created with very great ingenuity across more than 200 years now is geared to the idea that for innovation to happen, you need to protect people's freedom to innovate, in a sense. Let them have trade secrets if they need them. Let them keep it confidential. If they put things in the patent system, give them a period of time when they can enjoy the patent rights. Well, you can't have both meaningful public engagement and strict protection of the innovative capacity. And something that we discuss in that report is that if innovation is actually a distributed public activity. If much more of society is involved in the innovative process than just the corporate innovators and their science and technology departments, then how do we rebalance things like intellectual property rights and other forms of participatory or exclusionary laws when it comes to innovation? So I think that's all I had by way of prepared comments to start with. Let me let you take a go.